Welcome to the Go Hard Chick podcast. This is your host, Crystal Holmes. And today I bring you episode 14, Medical Cannabis Demystified with Dr. Felicia L. Dawson. Go Hard Chicks, Dr. Dawson is a cannabis advocate, educator, and consultant. Dr. Dawson practiced holistic gynecology and integrative and functional medicine for over 30 years. However, in December 2016, she closed her medical practice to focus on advocating, educating, and consulting on medical cannabis full time. Go Hard Chicks, I was blown away by the knowledge that Dr. Dawson has about medical marijuana, or as she corrected me, medical cannabis. This plant is amazing. I had no idea of the medical benefits that cannabis has. So if you're like me and you don't know a lot about cannabis, this is a great, really great interview to learn a whole lot more. Or if you know a little something about the plant, I'm certain you will learn something new from this interview today. And I'm definitely going to bring Dr. Dawson back for maybe a part two so we can learn even more. So Go Hard Chicks, welcome to the Go Hard Chick podcast. Go Hard Chick, Dr. Felicia L. Dawson. Welcome to the Go Hard Chick podcast, Dr. Dawson. How are you?
Thank you. I am great. How are you?
I am fabulous, and I am so honored that you agreed to come on today with me to discuss this topic of medical marijuana. I must admit, it's a topic that I do not know a lot about. That's why I wanted to have you on.
Well, I am so happy to be here, and I oftentimes hesitate when I share information about it in some of the Facebook groups that I belong to where physicians and attorneys are present. And so I like, okay, well, here we go. I'm trying to educate.
Well, we need the education. And that's what's important. That's why I wanted you on today. So before I start with all the questions that I have, let me ask you to, can you let the listeners know just a little bit about yourself and your background and why or how did you get into, medical marijuana?
Well, I'm originally from Illinois, and I was getting a little tired of the cold and increasing levels of snow in the winter times. So I came south to go to school. My parents are actually both from Alabama. So I went to the University of Alabama in Birmingham for my undergraduate, but I visited a cousin who lived in Atlanta one day or weekend and just fell in love with the city. So I transferred over here and finished my undergraduate degree at Emory. I then went over to Morehouse School of Medicine, where their strong feature is primary care, came back to Emory to specialize in OBGYN, my residency. So I am board certified in obstetrics and gynecology, and I later became board certified in integrative or holistic medicine. Around 2013, I started hearing about cannabis like the rest of the country with Sanjay Gupta's specials on weed. And at the same time, I was getting increasingly disenchanted with the business of medicine, with the liability, electronic medical records, governmental regulations, interference, so on and so on. So I was kind of turning away from the business of medicine and turning towards the practice of cannabis as medicine. I had no clue that cannabis was a medicine, because that's not what you're taught in medical school. And even as late as, I think, 2013, a survey of medical schools in America shows that only 13% of them even mention something called the endocannabinoid system, which is a system that all mammals, including humans, have, and which is the system that cannabis and CBD interacts with. So I'm just amazed and excited about this plant that can do so many things. So, in 2016, I decided to close my practice and devote 100% of my time trying to educate the public, our legislators, other physicians about the medicinal properties of cannabis, because it's not like it's a new thing. Our ancestors have been using it for thousands of years as medicine, fiber, and ritual, and just multiple things. So that's kind of how I got into it. And there's we as physicians actually used to use it. We used to prescribe it in America in the mid-1800s through the early 1900s. That's how part of mainstream medicine cannabis was. So, we don't even remember this history. And so it's just a fascinating chapter and all the legal ramifications and social equity and systemic racism and how it became illegal or whole fascinating subject. It's way bigger than just the medicine. So that's how I got into it.
Oh, wow. And we have a couple things in common. I'm from the Midwest myself, and I went to Emory Law School. So that's interesting. Yes. Now, let me ask you, because my ignorance, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this, I called it medical marijuana. Is it better to call it cannabis?
Yes, that is the scientific name for the plant. Marijuana came about during the time of Prohibition, and that's exactly how the first drug czar, Harry Anslinger, was able to get it prohibited because he called it marijuana. And we're not exactly sure of the origins. We think it was something, a misconception of what people were hearing the Mexicans were saying at the time, because at that time, Mexicans were immigrating into the country like in 1910, 1920, and there was a lot of anti-immigration fervor going on, much like today. And he called this plant marijuana and, the media portraying it as this new fangled thing from Mexico that's driving people mad and driving white women to be with jazz singers and have sex with black jazz musicians. And I mean, it was just a whole thing. And so, yes, the correct way to, or the scientific way to refer to it would be cannabis.
Okay. So I'm going to make sure, make it a point to refer to it as cannabis. So tell me, what is exactly in the cannabis plant? Like, what makes it helpful or harmful for people?
The cannabis plant is the most complex botanical I have ever learned about. It can do so many things. It is an excellent source of protein. It contains vitamins A, several B vitamins, vitamin E. It has essential fatty acids in it, like omega-3s, omega-6s, in a preferred ratio of 3 to 1, typically. It has things called terpenes in it, as most plants and vegetables. Terpenes are what gives fruits and vegetables and plants their flavor and aroma. Without terpenes, cannabis would not have a fragrance. Cannabis also contains flavonoids, and flavonoids are what gives plants their color. And these flavonoids are really good at fighting cancer, decreasing inflammation, quenching reactive oxygen species, which are free radicals. It's like when we have our body does this work, you know, our metabolism produces certain molecules. Some of them are, we call them reactive oxygen species, which can damage your DNA and damage your cell membranes. And they think what really is behind the promotion of chronic inflammation and cancer. So these flavonoids actually fight that. So cannabis is full of protein, vitamins, flavonoids, terpenes, and last but not least, cannabinoids, phytocannabinoids. The two most famous phytocannabinoids are THC, or tetrahydrocannabinol, and CBD, which is cannabidiol. THC is the part that, quote unquote, gets you high or intoxicated. CBD does not get you high. However, people like to say that THC is psychoactive and CBD is not psychoactive. But in fact, CBD actually decreases anxiety and depression and can decrease psychosis. So both of them are psychoactive. And this plant has actually over 140 different types of cannabinoids. So just think, if these two by themselves can do so many things, what else can this plant do? And that's one of the reasons why this plant has been kept illegal, because the pharmaceutical industry has been doing research trying to make synthetic forms of this plant, different components of this plant, for decades. That's part of the reason why it's still illegal, because the pharmaceutical industry is the largest lobbying organization in this country, to the tune of $270 million that they pour into the pockets of our politicians. And that's why this plant continues to be illegal. But we're at a tipping point where the majority of Americans now understand that this plant has medicinal properties. So I think we're getting close. I think it's going to be probably legal on a federal level within the next 1 or 2 years. That's my prediction.
Okay. That's some good information. So just so I understand, I mean, what is the difference, I guess, in the THC or the concentration of this plant in someone, let's say someone smoking marijuana versus someone who might be, I don't know, consuming gummies, or, you know, someone that's using maybe CBD oils for some various reasons?
So is the question like, what's the difference between recreational versus
right.
medicinal cannabis?
Right.
Okay. So in the recreational, or what we like to call it, adult use, because we feel that people who definitely use it on a regular oftentimes are self-medicating. And so we call it adult use, and is now, you know, available in 11 states now as adult use, where anyone who's over 21 can walk into a dispensary and purchase a cannabis. In general, adult use cannabis is bred to have a higher concentration of THC, 10, 20, 30%. Medicinal, on the other hand, doesn't always have that kind of an objective, because, you know, oftentimes when people are doing the recreational or adult use, it's a lot stronger than stronger in terms of THC content than medicinal. Some illnesses work better with a higher CBD concentration, and that's the biggest difference between medicinal and adult use or recreational. The medicinal has more varieties of CBD to THC content and ratios. And, you know, some states, I think a limited number, your insurance may actually reimburse you for that. So that's the biggest difference. I would just say adult use tends to be mainly about the THC. Medicinal is about full spectrum, multiple ratios of CBD to THC and lower THC content.
Now, you mentioned that recreational or adult use, you referred to those users as maybe self-medicating.
Yes, some people don't feel like themselves or don't feel good unless they are consuming cannabis. And so they feel more like themselves when they consume it.
So what kind of things could they possibly be self-medicating to treat?
Anxiety, depression, PTSD, those kind of things.
That's interesting, because I think, well, just in my experience, I don't know that a lot of the users that I know would even admit that they are self-medicating or even know that they are self-medicating.
Well, I I'm not saying that everyone who right. uses it that way is self-medicating, but a lot of them are. A lot of them are, and they right. just don't realize it.
Right. Now, you mentioned that, I guess, on the medical side of cannabis, that it can help treat some certain things like, or maybe the symptoms of cancer and different things. What are the general, I don't know if there are general, but what are some conditions that cannabis can be helpful in treating?
Okay. And I just forgot. I just remembered another thing that people can treat, may treat themselves for and not realize it. People with ADD may feel more functional on cannabis, can focus better. Cause there's all kinds of strains out there, cannabinoid ratios, some that actually promote concentration. And some of that has to do with the terpenes, those compounds that I stated earlier that give you the flavor and aroma. It actually, terpenes have been used in essential oils, is what aromatherapy is based on. And, you know, lavender can be calming, you know, limonene, these are things, or linalool in lavender, limonene in citrus fruits. You know, these fragrances can affect our mood and help us to feel happier or less depressed. And I apologize where we were going with this question.
No, that's fascinating. I did not know that about essential oils.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, those oils are in the plant kingdom in general. There's over 30,000 different types of terpenes identified in nature, and 200 of them are in cannabis.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. That's why this plant is so amazing. And as I mentioned earlier, the flavonoids, you know, over 6,000 have been identified in the plant kingdom, and at least 23 have been identified in cannabis. And again, those are compounds that can help with fighting cancer and inflammation and squelching a free radical activity.
Okay. So that brings me back to my question. You mentioned fighting cancer. What other types of illnesses can cannabis or the use of cannabis help with?
So I've already talked about anxiety, depression, PTSD, schizophrenia, autism. In terms of female health challenges, heavy bleeding, painful periods, endometriosis, fibroids, postpartum depression. And historically, I will have to say that cannabis was used to facilitate dysfunctional labor. If the woman's contractions were not strong enough, she was allowed to inhale burnt cannabis embers in a bowl and inhale it through her nose. And it would help her contractions get stronger and also decrease her pain during childbirth. It's been used historically to decrease postpartum hemorrhage or bleeding after the baby is delivered or retain placenta. It was used for menstrual irregularities, infrequent or frequent menstrual periods. Currently it's being used for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, cancer, seizures, nausea and vomiting associated with chemotherapy, neuropathy associated with chemotherapy, radiation therapy. So it's, you know, a lot of oncologists are okay with their patients using cannabis along with their conventional cancer treatment because it can decrease the side effects, frankly, of these treatments.
Now, for example, if someone is receiving cancer treatment and they want to, you know, use the cannabis to assist with the side effects, how are they using the cannabis?
Typically orally, by a tincture or oil. Historically, tinctures meant that the plant material was extracted with alcohol and you put a few drops beneath the tongue. Today, it's oftentimes being used interchangeably with alcohol-based cannabis or oil-based. But typically, when people are taking cannabis medicinally, it's usually orally, under a tongue or swallowing oil, and it can also be inhaled most safely with a vaporizer. Electronic vaporizer is much safer than rolling a joint and smoking it or using a vape pen. Electronic vaporizer does not heat or combust or burn the whole plant, and therefore you're able to access the terpenes and the cannabinoids much better. versus smoking it, combusting it, you're burning up and destroying half of the product. They've done studies showing that when people vaporize it, if you want to bring it in through your lungs because you need it quickly because you have horrible anxiety or PTSD or pain that you can't wait for, you know, an hour for it to kick in, smoking is or inhaling with a electronic vaporizer would be the way to go. But most people consume it as a tincture or oil because it's you can titrate it better. You can know what you're taking, that kind of thing.
Now, can these oils and oral, I guess the oral cannabis, can, is this prescribed?
Yes. I mean, you can get all forms of cannabis in a medical dispensary as well as an adult use dispensary. It's in all kind of forms, you know, not just oral and smoking. They're topicals. There are suppositories that can go into vagina or rectum. There's all kind of ways to use it. They're even working on inhalers, like, you know, like the inhalers that asthmatics have. To my understanding, there's a couple of inhalers on the market, actually.
Okay, that's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how open is the medical profession in general to, I mean, consenting to or acknowledging to a patient that it's okay for these types of treatments? If a patient comes in, for example, to their doctor and they may be a cancer patient, and let's say they said, look, I've heard that you know, cannabis may be helpful for me. Are physicians generally more accepting about these treatments, or there's still some pushback?
Oh, there's definitely some pushback. Mm-hmm. And I think it has to do with the age of the physician, because the younger physicians, they understand. They understand it better than the older physicians. The older physicians may have, you know, lived through the crack epidemic or had drug use in their family and are very against it. Because I remember when I was discussing my plans of, you know, trying to educate about cannabis full time, and I was telling some of my colleagues, and, you know, half of them were like, cool, man, that is so cool. Tell me more. And then the other half would be like, you're going to do what? Didn't we have enough trouble with crack cocaine? You know, it's like, so it's, everybody's not on board. And I think part of the hesitation for a lot of physicians is that they have so much on their plate as it is. You know, part of the reason I, you know, just got over, you know, all the things that physicians have to do. This is like the most stressful period in time to be a physician. And a lot of people just don't have the time to try to put one more thing on their plate, because you already have to keep up with continuing medical education, the expense of that, the time from your livelihood to do that, to maintain your license. And I think a lot of physicians are not that open to it because they just don't know much about it. They don't feel they have the time to learn about it, and therefore they don't know about it. They can't really counsel the patient one way or another. But I think if someone would really like to see if cannabis could be a better alternative for them versus a pharmaceutical, then it's important to be honest. And if you don't have a physician that can, you know, who's open-minded enough for you to even be able to be honest with them, and that the fact that you're trying to work with it so they can help you with your drug to herb interactions, because that's, you know, something that you have to be mindful of if you are taking seizure medicines or taking an antidepressant like a tricyclic antidepressant like amitriptyline. Some of those older antidepressants can be dangerous because of the drug herb interactions, because cannabis and CBD are both broken down in the liver, where all the other medications are being broken down, and toxins in your environment and food and, you know, all those kind of things. So I like to tell people, you know, if you want to see what cannabis can do for you, you have to make sure you're working with a physician who feels comfortable with it. And that's, you know, what I try to do. I do online educational consultations for patients whose physician may not be up to speed or maybe a little reticent up for, you know, trying to give information about it. And, you know, I'm happy to help people make that transition.
Okay, that's good information. Now, a question that I always see being asked is, can you become addicted to cannabis?
The answer is yes. However, I will say that it has a lower addiction rate than sugar and alcohol and other drugs like heroin and cocaine. The addiction rate is about 9%, which is the lowest of all those things I just mentioned. So there is a theoretically it is possible, but it's interesting that some people who have become addicted can use CBD, which is a constituent of cannabis, that can decrease cravings and decrease addiction. And there's no pharmaceutical on the market right now that can decrease cravings. So that's one interesting thing. The other thing is that if you have such a high THC content, that drives the risk of addiction more, because there are people who, you know, have been using cannabis since the 70s and they're experimenting with these higher TAC percentages, 10-20%, and they acknowledge that it is more difficult to get off of it or to stop it. So I caution people to stick more with a better blend where there's more CBD present and not just THC only. And THC, and I don't want to paint THC as the bad guy or the bad girl, because THC not only makes you feel good, it has medicinal value as well, with nausea and vomiting, with decreasing decreasing inflammation, with treating cancer. I mean, there are some cancers that CBD by itself cannot do a thing with. You need THC to fight some of these cancers, and a lot of it. So THC is not bad in and of itself, but when you breed a plant that once upon a time historically only contained about 4% THC, and now you're making it have 20 and 30%, that's a whole nother animal. That's not what the plant was before men, and I mean the ones with, I won't go there, started breeding it to make it more addicting and more profitable. And there are states that will actually tax it more. The higher the THC content, the more taxes you pay on it.
Okay, I see. So, I mean, how does one, if you're just going to a distributor, how do you know? Do they readily tell you the THC content? How does
Oh, yes. Yes, okay. Yes. It's, I mean, if it's a legitimate place, that's one thing that you want to know for CBD or cannabis, there should be a certificate of analysis associated with that product. It should be on the label. That means that this product has been tested by an independent third party. It's been tested for how much THC is in it, how much CBD is in it, and how much other cannabinoids is in it. It's free of mold. It's free of microorganisms and parasites. It's free of heavy metals. It's been manufactured with certified good manufacturing processes. You know, it should be clearly on the package.
Okay, so this goes without saying. If you're going to your local, I don't know,
dispensary,
or drug dealer, you're not going to know what's in there.
True.
More than likely.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's one of the most dangerous things about this whole prohibition, federal prohibition of cannabis, you know, and some of these taxes that they're putting on the legal product is driving people back into the black market, or that's part of the reason why the legal market is not taking off as it should, because all of the taxes being put on cannabis are keeping people in the black market. And with the recession that we're in now and possible depression coming, people are going to be trying to go to the black market, and no, you don't know what's in it. You know, people are putting all kind of toxins to extract the psychoactive compounds out of the plant, and you're smoking it or heating it, and that it is turning into something else. And one thing that I didn't mention is another thing besides burning up your product when you smoke it, smoking any plant material, be it cannabis or tobacco, generates approximately 1,500 contaminants, carcinogens, cancer-causing molecules. So that's another reason why smoking is not recommended, because of that fact. They used to try to prove that cannabis, smoking cannabis, caused lung cancer, but I believe that it has so many anti-cancer, anti-inflammatory properties that it helps to balance out that tendency to cause lung cancer, but it can definitely cause chronic bronchitis and increase mucus production if you smoke it versus vaporize it.
Okay, I did not know that. So, for example, if someone suffers from, I don't know, severe allergies, or maybe they have, I don't know, they probably shouldn't be smoking the marijuana or the cannabis.
Well, some lungs, like with asthma, where you have a bronchospasm or constriction of your alveoli, blanking on that word, cannabis relaxes smooth muscle. That's why it helps to open up the lungs when people are having trouble breathing. But in general, if you have trouble with your lungs, it's better to vaporize or take your medicine or take your cannabis orally, or, you know, under your tongue or something like that.
Okay. Now, I want to swing back, because this is so interesting to me regarding, you mentioned it helps, or the THC helps to fight cancer. Does the THC help to fight the cancer or help with the side effects, or both?
Both. It not only helps with the side effects, CBD and THC, they both work to decrease cancer's tendency to metastasize or spread to other places. It inhibits its ability to form new blood vessels, and that's how it gets to spread, because it has a special propensity to be able to make new blood vessels so it can move to other parts of the body. It helps it to not multiply so much. That's called being anti-proliferative. So it stops you from dividing so quickly. And both of these also promote apoptosis, which is programmed cell death. Cancer cells have forgotten how to die. It's like typically when a cell becomes abnormal because its DNA has been injured or something to that effect, it has been programmed to kill itself. And cancer are cells that have forgotten how to kill themselves. They begin to act like little egos, and I must survive, I must survive, I must divide, I must replicate, I must survive. And it's because that cell has lost its part of its intelligence, and cannabis helps it to die.
Okay, I did not know that. So let me ask you this. Could one consume CBD, for example, as a preventative measure? Maybe they don't have cancer, but they want to prevent certain disease.
Yes, they can. And it is recommended to, you know, do something low dose. A lot of practitioners will recommend starting at, say, 5 milligrams twice a day and stay there for a couple of days and, you know, see how you feel, and go up maybe by 5 milligrams per dose every couple of days and just see where you feel, or just leave it at 5 milligrams. If you are in perfect health, you know, you can leave it there. But I can tell you that, and the reason why I say that is because we are constantly bombarded with things that do not promote our health. And I know that you've talked about a lot of them on your podcast, like a lack of sleep, poor diet, excessive electromagnetic waves from our smart devices, toxins in the environment, poor air quality, poor water quality, all of these things are physiologic stressors. And although our endocannabinoid system, which is what the cannabis plant interacts with, and we make our own molecules similar to the cannabis plant, except these endocannabinoids that we make are a lot weaker than the ones in the plant. And because we, you know, all these stressors, physiologic stressors, mental stressors, over time, they make our endocannabinoid system not work well. And that means we become endocannabinoid deficient. And there's actually a term that was created or hypothesized about by Dr. Ethan Russo, who hypothesized that some of these autoimmune illnesses are due to clinical endocannabinoid deficiency. And researchers later proved him to be correct. All these autoimmune diseases like fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, multiple sclerosis, they are all states of endocannabinoid deficiency. And we are all being subjected to multiple environmental and mental stressors that are tearing down our endocannabinoid system. And that's why people feel better when they use CBD or cannabis.
Okay, so I guess in the perfect world, you should try to reduce those stressors first.
Yes.
But the CBD is there to help if need be.
Yes, and it's okay to use both of them. It's just like when people become suicidal or become so depressed that they don't want to get out of their bed. You know, an antidepressant can give you the mental clarity and the energy to get out of bed and go to therapy and figure out what's really the problem. You know, why, what's really causing your depression. And same thing with cannabis and CBD. They can help you as you make those changes in your life.
Okay.
Because I always say that illness is your body trying to get your attention, or the universe trying to get your attention, that you need to do or see something differently. Mm-hmm. And some people will say cancer was the best thing that ever happened to them because they get their priorities together.
It's like a wake up.
And that happens. Exactly.
Now, I think you may have mentioned this, but just so I'm clear, pain is cannabis helpful with people who may be suffering from some significant pain?
Yes, that is the most common reason that people use cannabis for pain.
Okay. And would you say it's more effective than, say, other types of painkillers?
Everybody is different. What I can say is that it's safer than other painkillers. It's not, there's never been a case of cannabis killing someone. However, there are many cases of people dying from alcohol, tobacco, and opioids. We have plenty of that, but no one's ever died from cannabis.
Can you overdose on cannabis?
You can take too much cannabis and have a very unpleasant time. You know, cannabis can be sedating in low doses. You can be fine. However, really, really high doses may cause your heart to beat really fast. You can start having hallucinations, you know, those kind of things. But typically, even if you take too much, and that's typically what people experience when they go to these adult use states where it's legal, like Nevada or Colorado, California, they take in an edible and they don't wait 2 or 3 hours to see what effect it has on them. They say, I don't feel anything. Let me take more. And then they overdose and start seeing things, hearing things, having a bad time. And, you know, it eventually is going to get out of your system, you know, in about 24 to 48 hours. So yes, you can take too much. That's why it's important, whether you're medicating or experimenting just to have a good time or feel better, you want to start at a low dose and go up very slowly.
Okay. So here's a question that I've always wondered, and I see that it's been debated here and there. Is cannabis, do you think cannabis is a gateway drug?
No, I don't. That's part of the prohibition influence. There's a lot of things out here that can help people get into more dangerous activities. But no, I don't believe it's a gateway drug. You have to understand that, again, this cannabis was prescribed by physicians for almost 100 years before it was made illegal for racist and greed, for racist reasons and greed. And greed continues to propel this engine forward as the pharmaceutical company pays our politicians to keep it illegal. It also is being used to racially profile people of color so they can be, you know, stopped and find other reasons to get more people of color into the prison system or the prison industrial complex, because these prisons make money. And that's one of the reasons why that gateway thing is being promoted. In addition, once it became prohibited, and, you know, and the research continued probably until about 1970, until the Supreme Court overturned the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937 and found that the federal prohibition was unconstitutional. At that time, Richard Nixon renewed the war on drugs and created the Controlled Substance Act to make cannabis illegal immediately again. So that's used to control people of color. And it was also used to clamp down on Vietnam protesters, which happened to be young people at that time. So that leaks into all of the government institutions, so much so that for a while, the government, well, that's really, it's probably still true today. The government would only give researchers money to research cannabis, and typically they're using synthetic forms of cannabis, or government grown cannabis, which is at the University of Mississippi, which is inferior and does not represent what's available in dispensaries. The government would only give researchers grants and funding to prove that cannabis was dangerous. And if your results showed that cannabis was medicinal, your funding dried up.
Okay, so there are a lot of layers to this whole thing.
Yes, there are.
Wow. Well, Dr. Dawson, thank you so much. This was completely helpful to me in my understanding. We probably need to have you come back on.
It would be my pleasure to come back on, because I learn new things about this plant every day. It's just an amazing, complex, intelligent plant. And it's just amazing what it, if we could just free it for federal bondage, it could allow researchers to do the work that's needed so that people can feel, you know, safe about it and know what to use for certain things and how much to use.
Right. And you certainly helped dispel some myths, because I think there are a lot of myths out there about cannabis. And, it, you know, it might just be because of people's limited, you know, experience and knowledge. But you were extremely, extremely helpful to me today and to the listeners. If people want to reach out to you or contact you to learn more about you, Dr. Dawson, how can they do so?
The best way is to reach me through my website, which is drfelicia.com. And doctor is spelled out D-O-C-T-O-R, Felicia, F as in fish, E-L-E-C-I-A, two E's, drfelicia.com. And you can fill out the contact form and it comes right to my email or my phone number is on there too, 770-648-4956. That is the best way. And then you can also access my social media through my website. I'm on Facebook primarily. I do show up on Instagram occasionally. I also have a Twitter account. So you can access all of my social media through my website. And that would be the best way to see what I'm talking about, because I try to share as new relevant information comes out on my social media. I tend to do that. And also, I periodically send an email out to let people know where I will be speaking. Of course, I'm not speaking anywhere of late because of COVID-19, but that's how you can best get in touch with me.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Dr. Dawson. I sincerely appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Well, there you have it, Go Hard Chicks. Another great episode, this time with Dr. Felicia L. Dawson. Go Hard Chicks, if you enjoyed this episode, please leave a rating and review. Leaving a rating and review really helps me to continue to bring you guys awesome content and guests like Dr. Dawson. Additionally, please share the podcast with your friends, family, and anybody else you know that wants to learn more about bettering their lives through health and wellness. Go Hard Chicks, thanks again for listening. Take care.